You're listening to the Merry Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
I want to live again, and I want to look him straight in the eye, and I want to tell him what a cheap, lying, no good, rotten, four-flushing, low-life, snake-licking, dirt-eating, inbred, overstuffed, ignorant, blood-sucking, dog-kissing, brainless.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercial. Makeup, even in Brooklyn it's the same.
That thing had nine lives, she just spent them all.
Woo! I triple dog dare you!
I don't believe you're an angel. I think you're a demon right out of...
Oh, Henry, don't say that.
Does someone need a hug?
Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Sentimental hogwash.
What was the last thing you and Charlie did before you went to bed Christmas Eve?
We shared a bowl of sugar, some shots of brown liquor, played with my shotguns, field dressed a cat, looked for women.
I'm the worst toy maker in the world. I'm a cotton-headed ninny muggins.
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding! Doo-doo pedals! Doo-doo! There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas!
Hello and welcome to this, the 15th episode of the Merry Podcast of My Merry Christmas. My name is Jeff Westover, founder of the feast at MyMerryChristmas.com, the internet's longest ongoing celebration of Christmas, and of the Merry Forums, the world's largest year-round Christmas community. Christmas and romance have a long history dating all the way back to Joseph and Mary, which is a love story overshadowed by the story of Christmas itself, and one we will tell in this episode. In this jam-packed edition of the podcast, we also observe the beginnings of Operation Merry Christmas, brought to us by SantaUpdate.com, as we begin our annual tradition of tracking Santa Claus. And speaking of Santa Claus, this episode of the Merry Podcast is brought to us by our friends at PackageFromSanta.com. Love is the predominant message of Christmas, and when it comes to your kids, nothing speaks love like the magic of Santa at Christmas. Give your kids a little more love with a package from Santa this Christmas. And since our theme this time around is love, we'll begin by showing a little love to the new artists out there bringing us fresh Christmas music for the season, starting us out with a love song titled The Christmas I Met You is Shay Arender, whose song hit the top 40 adult contemporary music charts just this week.
Do you remember when our lives were so complete? Long cold December, so bittersweet. But if I could set aside one day that I could hold forever, I would say the Christmas I met you is it still magic, although we've grown apart. It seems so tragic, so frail the heart. But if I was blessed with just one wish to take me through my lonely life my wish to go back to the Christmas I met you. And when you feel you're own, but just believe you're not alone, and you'll feel the warmth that we shared years ago. I broke down and cried. So if you can't find it in your heart to be forgiven to a broken man, I'd go back to the Christmas I met you. But if I could set aside one day that I could hold forever, I would say to go back to the Christmas I met you.
Stay with us here and on Merry Christmas Radio, where we feature Shay and a host of other new artists launching new music for this year. Lots more new music ahead here on the Merry Podcast. In fact, it is a busy time here in the month of December. Not only is it Christmas, but it is also what we call contest season. We'll hold trivia contests, song mashups, and online scavenger hunts for fun and prizes in the build-up to Christmas, including more CDs by Shay. So stop by the Merry Forums for more details. And don't forget our upcoming Christmas party set for noon to midnight in every time zone around the world on December 11th. We call it the world's largest Christmas party, and it is scheduled with a ton of Christmas-themed events like chats, workshops on Christmas topics. Santa will be there live for chats with the kids, and we'll be counting down the top 100 Christmas songs of all time, plus a live radio broadcast with Jay and the crew at Merry Christmas Radio. This is all the results of months worth of surveys from you, our listeners, and the site users of the Merry Network. The overall theme of the Christmas party is Christmas Where You Are, featuring a video contest, a photo contest, and an essay contest, all on the same theme of Christmas Where You Live, with loads of prizes for our participants. A world-class event, like the world's largest Christmas party, should share what Christmas is like around the world, and that is our goal. Speaking of Christmas around the world, here is the latest from the North Pole.
This is breaking news from SantaUpdate.com.
Hello, world, from the North Pole Newsroom. I'm reporter Rusty Bells, reporting all that is worth reporting from the North Pole and Operation Merry Christmas 2011. With Christmas about 3 weeks away, things are very busy at the North Pole. Work on Santa's sleigh continues, with the goal of making it Santa's fastest sleigh ever. Elf Quinton says that this year, Santa will employ new Teflon's coated skid. You ought to try saying that fast. And radar reflecting shields that might make his sleigh harder than ever to spot by computers. Elf Quinton says the new materials will add a new level of aerodynamics that may help shave time off of the speed records Santa set just last year. Santa will begin test flying the new sleigh in about a week. Things are very exciting at Santa's stables, as Elf South, Victor announced that hundreds of new baby reindeer have been born over the past few months and are beginning their flight training. Santa doesn't have time to name all of these new babies, so he's asking for your help. Just visit SantaUpdate.com to suggest a name for Santa to use for one of his new reindeer. From the North Pole, I'm Trusty Rusty, your source for all the news of Santa on the radio, reporting for Merry Christmas Radio.
If you could mark dates on the calendar as pivotal in the history of Christmas, what would those dates be? No doubt there would be many dates we could mark, but amongst the most important would have to be the Christmas season of 1944. The season was a grim time for the world as war raged in the East and in the West. For a whole generation of young people in nations around the world, it would be their first Christmas from home, and for many it would prove to be a hellish experience. Swirling amongst these circumstances over the airwaves was the voice of Bing Crosby singing the song White Christmas, which seemed to convey what nearly everyone of that generation was feeling about Christmases they used to know. Caught up in that sentiment was a 18-year-old in Oklahoma whose draft orders had not yet arrived. Deeply in love, young Frank took pen to paper and composed a song for his girl. Like White Christmas, it spoke of spending Christmas apart and dreaming of a wonderful reunion. Unfortunately for Frank, whose musical talents were many, things didn't work out with his girl. Before he ever had the chance to give her his song, they broke up, and it was filed away in the dustbin of history. After the war, Frank got his education and pursued a career in music, eventually becoming a choir director at the collegiate level. Some 20 years after the war, he was coaching a pair of 18-year-olds who were trying to make it big in music, and they wanted to do a Christmas song. Tired of all the old favorites, they asked Frank if he had anything that they could use. It was the first time Frank had even thought of the song he wrote for the girl he lost during the war. It wasn't much of a song, he told them, but you can do what you want with it. Looking it over, the young Richard, all of 18 years old and every bit the romantic Frank was at the same age, devised a tune in 15 minutes. Little did he know, and little could Frank have imagined, the song would become a hit and be played over and over every Christmas after it was first recorded in 1970. The song is Merry Christmas, Darling by the Carpenters. Here is Karen Carpenter talking a little bit about the song from a radio interview she did in the late 1970s as their Christmas album Christmas Portrait came out.
Merry Christmas, Darling, I think is a little extra special to both of us because, Richard wrote it, and the lyrics were written by the choral conductor at Long Beach State Choir, where we went to school, Frank Pooler. And Frank was very helpful in our college days. While we were trying to get a contract and constantly missing classes and everything, he was the only one down there that actually understood what we were after, and he stuck behind us all the way. And we just did a benefit at Long Beach State for a scholarship fund, and we did it with the choir and the whole thing. We did Christmas Darling, and he just glows every time we do it. You know, it's a beautiful song. I think it's my favorite because it's really close to me.
Merry Christmas, Darling was first produced as a single in 1970 and saw widespread airplay. But when it came time for the Carpenters to produce a whole album of Christmas music, Karen Carpenter wanted to re-record the song because she wasn't happy with the vocals recorded 8 years earlier. It is this 1978 version most commonly heard on the radio today. Richard Carpenter enjoys the 1970 versions much better, calling the recording a more pure representation of Karen's talent. Here is that rarely heard 1970 version of the song.
Greeting cards have all been sent. The Christmas rush is through, but I still have one wish to make. A special one for you. Merry Christmas, darling. We're apart, that's true. But I can dream, and in my dreams, I'm Christmasing with you. Days joyful. There's always something new. But every day's a holiday when I'm near to you. The lights on my tree, I wish you could see. I wish it every day. Lots on the farm fill me with desire to see you and to say that I wish you Merry Christmas.
Christmas darling.
Happy New Year.
Listening to Merry Christmas Radio, the official radio station of the Merry Network.
Oh, I want you for Christmas. I'm old enough to know what I want. Oh, I want what I want. I'll get what I want. Christmas morning, baby. I only want you.
Welcome again to the Merry Podcast Screening Room. For this edition of the Merry Podcasts, our founder of the feast, Jeff Westover, asked me to choose the five greatest romantic moments in classic Christmas movies. Most Hollywood Christmas movies focus more on love of humanity than love of a particular fellow man or woman. But a little romance is usually included in the plot, like a candy cane in a mug of hot chocolate. After some thought and a little digging, here is the Merry Podcast countdown of five of those memorable romantic moments. Number five is an unlikely Christmastime romance between a practical, divorced single mother and an idealistic young lawyer, Maureen O'Hara and John Payne, in the 1947 version of Miracle on 34th Street. At first, it looks like this romance could work. Kris Kringle himself plays Cupid for Doris and Fred.
Those two are a couple of lost souls, and it's up to us to help them. I'll take care of Susie if you'll take care of her mother.
It's a deal.
But when Fred volunteers to represent Kris at an insanity hearing, practical Doris criticizes him for jeopardizing his career for a sentimental whim, and the romance grows chilly. Then, on Christmas Day, little Susan's faith in Santa Claus rekindles their feelings for each other.
Oh, you were right, Mommy. Mommy told me if things don't turn out just the way you want them to the first time, you still got to believe. And I kept believing, and you were right, Mommy. Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
You told her that? The sign outside said it's for sale. We can't let her down.
I never really doubted you. It was just my silly common sense.
It even makes sense to believe in me now. I must be a pretty good lawyer. I'd take a little old man and legally prove to the world that he's Santa Claus. Now, you know that...
When they spot Kris's cane in the corner, they realize that Santa is still playing Cupid.
Oh, No, it can't be. It must have been left here by the people that moved out.
Maybe. Maybe I didn't do such a wonderful thing after all.
Number 4 is a musical romance. Rosemary Clooney and Bing Crosby in the 1954 film White Christmas. The setting is the Pine Tree Inn in Vermont, where Broadway producer Bob and his partner Phil are staging the entertainment, including the Haynes sisters. Phil is feeling overworked, so he urges his workaholic partner to think about getting married. When Bob meets Betty Haynes, it looks like she may be the girl who can snag him.
Well, hello. What's doing?
I couldn't sleep.
Well, you're a little young for that route, aren't you?
I can't understand what's wrong with me. I usually don't have any trouble sleeping.
Well, you've come to the right fella. Here, sit down. You know, I have a theory about that, too. Would you like to hear it?
Very much.
If you're worried and you can't sleep, just count your blessings instead of sheep, and you'll fall asleep counting your blessings.
I guess I've always been kind of a silly schoolgirl. You know the bit, the Lady Fair and the Knight on the White Horse.
Makes a fella feel a little shaky to go up there all alone on one of those bleached chargers.
And you worried?
Kinda.
If you're worried and you can't sleep, just count your blessings instead of sheep, and you'll fall asleep counting your blessings.
Number 3 is Barbara Stanwyck and Dennis Morgan in the 1945 film Christmas in Connecticut. Elizabeth is a 1940s Martha Stewart who has to pose as a wife and mother living on a farm in Connecticut to please her magazine publisher, who has sent a war hero to spend Christmas on her farm. Of course, Elizabeth and Jeff are instantly attracted to each other, but he believes she's married, she believes he's engaged, and she can't reveal the truth or she'll lose her job.
If I wasn't married, what would you say to me now?
Well, first I'd call you Lishka, like Uncle Felix does.
Say it.
Lishka.
Say it again.
Lishka.
And then what would you say?
I guess I couldn't say anything.
I know. It's all so lovely. So lovely.
You're lovely, too.
Go on. Don't stop.
You're making fun of me.
No. I'm having fun, I admit that, but believe me, if I'm making fun of anybody, it's Elizabeth Lane.
You're not very happy, are you?
Well, I'm as happy as I have any right to be.
I think you deserve all the happiness in the world.
You do?
I think you're wonderful.
You do?
Maybe we better turn back.
No, not yet.
In the final reel, Jeff learns that his engagement is broken and makes a bold play for Elizabeth.
I warn you, if you take another step, I'll scream.
Go ahead and scream. Scream the house down. Perhaps your husband will come to your rescue.
I haven't got a husband.
You haven't?
No.
I know something you don't know. I'm not engaged anymore.
You're not?
I'm as free as a bird.
Oh, that's what you think.
Number 2 is one of Hollywood's most unusual love triangles. David Niven as a bishop, Loretta Young as his wife, and Cary Grant as an angel in the 1947 film The Bishop's Wife. Julia feels neglected because Henry's new duties as bishop leave him no time for his family and friends. A frustrated Henry prays for help. Enter Dudley the Angel, who installs himself as the bishop's assistant and proves very capable at keeping Julia happy while the bishop is occupied with business matters. Henry becomes jealous of Dudley, and with good reason.
Julia.
Yes?
I don't want to leave.
Why?
There are a few people who know the secret of making a heaven here on Earth. You are one of those rare people.
I think you ought to go.
No, please, Julia. Don't send me away.
What are you saying, Dudley?
I'm tired of being a wanderer. I'm tired of an existence where one is neither hot nor cold, hungry nor full.
No. No. No, you must go away. And never come back.
When Dudley's mission is complete, he leaves a few words of advice that Henry takes to heart.
Take her in your arms and hold her tight. Kiss her for me, you lucky Henry.
Henry, what is it?
I don't know. I just have the most inexplicable feeling of happiness.
Oh.
You know something?
What?
Downstairs in the kitchen, there's a big bowl of cider.
Yes, that's for tomorrow afternoon.
So let's drink it now. Let's drink to us, to our happiness, and to what lies ahead. And then let's smash the glasses in the fireplace.
And number one has to be Donna Reed and James Stewart in the 1946 classic It's a Wonderful Life. One of the things that makes George Bailey's seemingly humdrum life truly wonderful is his romance with Mary.
George Bailey, I'll love you till the day I die.
You know, if it wasn't me talking, I'd say you were the prettiest girl in town.
Well, why don't you say it?
What is it you want, Mary? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Why don't you kiss her instead of talking her to death?
He's making violent love to me, Mother.
Will you tell that guy I'm giving him the chance of a lifetime, do you hear? The chance of a lifetime.
He says it's the chance of a lifetime.
Where are you two going on this here now, honeymoon?
We're gonna shoot the works. A whole week in New York, a whole week in Bermuda, the highest hotels, the oldest champagne, the richest caviar, the hottest music, and the prettiest wife.
Mary Hatch, why in the world do you ever marry a guy like me?
I want my baby to look like you.
You didn't even have a honeymoon. I promised you.
Mary, you on the nest?
George Bailey Lasso Stork.
Have a hectic day?
Well, yeah, another big red letter day for the Baileys. I said I wish I'd never been born.
All right. You've got your wish. You've never been born.
Hurry, it's George. Don't you know me? What's happened to us?
I don't know. You let me go.
Mary, please. Oh, don't do this to me. Please, Mary. Help me. Where's our kids? I need you, Mary. Mary!
George! George,
Mary!
Darling.
Mary!
George, darling, where have you gone? Oh, George.
You have no idea what's happened to me.
I have no idea what happened. Remember the night we broke the windows in this old house? This is what I wished for.
And that's the Mary Podcast's 5 greatest romantic moments in Christmas movies. If we've overlooked your favorite, please visit the Mary Podcast thread in the Mary forums at mymerrychristmas.com and tell us about yours. And by all means, watch one of these Christmas classics with someone you love to inspire a few romantic moments of your own. From the Mary Podcast projection room, this is Mary Carey. Merry Christmas and happy holiday viewing.
It's getting close to Christmas, and there's still so much to do. Moms and dads, if your child would like to receive a personalized letter from yours truly, visit packagesfromsanta.com now. Every child deserves a special letter from Santa at Christmas time, but you have to hurry. We're ready for your visit now at the original personalized Santa letter website, packagesfromsanta.com. Merry Christmas!
Don't
want to miss you this Christmas. I want to be with you this Christmas. It's been too long, but I've been away, so I'm coming home, even only for one day. So light up the lights, decorate the tree, I'll be with you. Wait and see, light a candle, pour out the old songs, I'll be there with you. It won't be long. This is my Christmas wish. This is my plea to be with you on Christmas Eve. I can't wait to see all your faces. It's gonna be such a surprise. The kids are getting so excited. There's a magic glow in their eyes. So light up the lights, decorate the tree, I'll be with you. Just wait and see, light a candle, pour out the old songs, I'll be there with you. It won't be long, this is my Christmas wish. This is my plea to be with you on Christmas Eve. Something you can hold forever. This Christmas won't be lonely and sad. This Christmas you can only be glad. I'll give you my love, I can't stay away. I give you my heart this Christmas day. This is my plea to be with you on Christmas Eve.
He was born the middle of seven children in the great American Northwest. His father was an English-American bookkeeper and his mother a second-generation Irish-American, making young Harry about as American as apple pie. The rest of his story is classically American as well, as he grew to become one of the grandest figures in Christmas history, touching a variety of American industries and becoming the first multimedia superstar. Harry was born in an era predating airplanes and radios and automobiles. By the time he would pass from this world, he mastered the emerging technologies of the 20th century. It made him rich beyond his wildest dreams, and famous and respected all over the world. Growing up in Spokane, Washington, the magic of technology was far from young Harry's mind and even further still from his grasp, but he had quite the active imagination and loved to read a spoof newspaper publication from his hometown. Harry so loved to read and mimic the Sunday feature that a neighbor took to calling Harry Bingo from Bingville, a name that somehow stuck with him. Harry would henceforth be known as Bing, and with that, you know the Christmas legend of whom I speak.
Of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write,
Bing Crosby's rise to superstardom is a familiar American success story. He was a man of considerable talent whose hard work put him in the right place at the right time and continues to inspire generations of Americans born long after he died. His early success influenced an entire stable of American artists who fashioned their own talents after his and tried to mimic his business success. Frank Sinatra, Perry Como, Dean Martin, and Tony Bennett all credit Bing Crosby as a guiding influence. Bennett's uncle told young Tony to keep your eye on Bing Crosby. He's the one you want to be like. He taught us all how to do it, Bennett says. What was it? It was a warm musical style that combined elements of note-bending jazz with the rhythm of pop to create a sound that seemed to reach out from the radio and affect people. It was more than just the buttery smooth delivery of his singing style. It was a distinctive overall package and is perhaps best described by Crosby himself in this song called Doin' the Bing.
Sorta buff your pinkies, flex your wrist. This is even bigger than the twist. Horns don't ring, no strings goes in. Doing the Bing. Gum your briar, make no haste. Never let a wiggle go to waste. Bells don't ring, don't ting-a-ling. Doing the Bing. It's a dainty little dance. Hully gully, not a chance. Just relax, no strain, no tax. You're passing the test if you crawl and you creep. You're doing it best if you fall asleep. Nudge your knee bones, elbows out. Both your arms akimbo, don't shout. Songs don't swing, don't ring, ding, ding. Doing the Bing.
It is difficult for many young people today to think of Bing Crosby in these terms. That is likely because Crosby had such a long career that was masterfully managed and crafted as he aged. His impact, especially on Christmas music, is indeed ageless. But in 1928, Crosby was just another singer from a jerkwater town whose inspiration was born of vaudeville performers. Al Jolson was a favorite, for example, and as performers would come into Spokane's small theater where Bing worked, he learned the craft of using his voice to great effect in hearing the likes of Jolson belt out song after song to reach those in the back rows. Bing paired with other singers and band leaders of that time, getting radio airtime and solo spots as he began to be recognized for his singular baritone sound and the terrific range that enabled him to perform a wide variety of music. Here is an early recording of the young Bing Crosby.
Beautiful girl, you're a lovely picture. Beautiful girl, just a gorgeous mixture of all that lies under those big blue skies. My heart cries, beautiful girl, you're a dazzling eyeful. Beautiful girl, I could never trifle. If I had you, you'd be my dreams come true.
His earliest known Christmas song was a solo version of Silent Night, but it would become just the first in a long line of Christmas performances. By 1931, Crosby had gone solo, performing with some of the biggest bands of the era, capturing radio audiences on both CBS and NBC radio networks. The segments were just 15 minutes long, but they were so effective in reaching America's youth that Bing became, seemingly overnight, a sensation. This was in a time long before Elvis, Sinatra, or the Beatles, and he would go on to greater heights, some would say, than all of those artists combined. Crafting his musical style was one thing. Getting radio producers to allow him to perform it the way he wanted was quite another. In this respect, the early efforts of Bing Crosby foreshadowed what was to come in future heartthrobs Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. The creative stifling that Crosby suffered from was not unique. While radio was the perfect medium to make him known, he had to sing the songs in a different way than his talent dictated. He clashed with producers over sound quality, song length, and arrangement, insisting that their only concern was for the studio audience who saw him, versus the millions instead who were only hearing him. To prove his point, he merely pointed to the toupee they made him wear. As Crosby's influence and wealth expanded, so too did his reach in changing the circumstances of how he performed. In building his career, he had pioneered the art of singing with, instead of in front of, the microphone. Those early bits of artistic touches with the microphone might seem to be simple showmanship today that everybody does, but back in those days, it was radical and unheard of, and it changed how artists performed and put the focus on the soloist instead of the band playing behind him. Crosby built his own studios and started to record his own shows. This allowed him to place the microphones where he wanted, to produce the numbers he wanted in the way that he wanted them. He would rehearse and record before trying it before a studio audience, sometimes using the rehearsal copies of the recording in a final show package instead of the live performance. It took some doing, but Crosby was finally able to persuade the network to air his recorded programs. This allowed him to focus on show production in the studio, sometimes producing an entire series of shows at one time, while freeing up his time for live performances. This broadened his exposure even more. In the production of his own shows, Crosby invented standard techniques that are still in use today. He invented the laugh track, for example. Working with German engineers prior to World War II, Crosby invested in the development of recording tape technology that was so clean it could be used to produce broadcast quality recordings that sounded as good as live performances. This led to other things like overdubbing, allowing an artist to harmonize with himself or with other singers, taking the performance of a song to a whole new level. Throughout the 1930s and into the 1940s, Crosby became the leading singer in America and radio's biggest star. He parlayed that into acting, eventually starring in 79 feature films over the course of his career. This dual media exposure made Crosby the first superstar and set the stage for a later career that kept him in demand well into his 70s. Outside of performing music and acting, Crosby was a savvy businessman who invested heavily in technology and new business. His self-produced radio shows, for example, were sponsored by something called Minute Maid Orange Juice, an emerging idea at the time built on investors like Crosby. He dabbled in golf, using his love for the game to promote charities, and he became one of the biggest owners in racehorse history. Though he often joked on his shows about his horses coming in last, for decades the horses produced on his farms excelled and established Crosby in the world of horse racing with a sterling reputation.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
His image was wholly American. In tune with the times, Crosby seemed to sing what people were thinking. When Irving Berlin wrote the song White Christmas in 1941, there was never another choice when it came down to who would be singing it. And though a simple song, according to Crosby himself, it spoke directly to the American heart and soared to the top of the charts and stayed there, year after year after year. For 11 consecutive Christmas seasons, other artists tried to knock off White Christmas, including Crosby himself, with other classic tunes like I'll Be Home for Christmas and It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas. But White Christmas could not be stopped, eventually becoming the best-selling single of all time, outperforming decades of classic hits from artists all over the world. At 70 years old, the song White Christmas remains the de facto anthem of Christmas, with hundreds of millions sold and making it the most performed Christmas song by artists in nearly every genre. World War II not only redefined Christmas music in America, it too reshaped an emerging image of Bing Crosby, who along with Bob Hope served during the war entertaining the troops in war zones. He was the man everyone wanted to hear sing, and by 1948, he was considered the most trusted man in America, bigger than the President of the United States, and even the Pope. During these years, Crosby began to churn out what we now consider classic Christmas albums. Jingle Bells, sung with the Andrews Sisters, Mele Kiliki Maka, and Christmas in Killarney continue to be alternative Bing favorites. As the 1950s came around, Crosby naturally took to television and annual Christmas television specials. In 1957, he produced another Christmas album, this one called How Lovely is Christmas.
How lovely is
is Christmas with boughs in the hall. When bells ringle jingle and friends come to call, how lovely.
As time marched on, Crosby took on the role of the elder statesman of music, appearing alongside Elvis, Sinatra, and other stars of the day. He remained visible and in demand well into the 1970s. From Merry Christmas Radio, here is Jay Isherwood discussing with Bing's daughter, Mary Crosby, the experience of recording his final Christmas show with David Bowie in 1977.
I remember the final Christmas special that you all did. I believe you were filming it in England, and it was in September, I think, of 1977, at least. Actually, a little bit of trivia, which my head seems to be full of, is that it was on this day in 1977 that your dad and David Bowie recorded that incredible song that appeared on that show. And one of the stories that I've heard is that your dad was somewhat reluctant at first to have David Bowie on, because of Mr. Bowie's rather alternative proclivities. And but what came of his performance on that show is absolutely one of my all-time favorite Christmas songs, and it's the Peace on Earth Little Drummer Boy duet that they do. Were you around when they were recording that?
Absolutely. I remember the experience well, and I think that it wasn't about David's proclivities, as you put it. Uh-huh. I really wasn't. I think that he just wasn't sure that it would be a very good mix.
Right.
It wasn't about who David was. It was just that, and when they got to the piano, and it was very funny because David walked in with his wife at the time, and you weren't sure who was who because they had cut their hair
right
exactly the same and dyed it red, and they were both in sort of full length mink coats. And this is my memory as a child, so of course I could be tweaking it, but this is what I remember, is that they were both exactly androgynously the same.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, none of that really mattered because David is an extraordinary musician.
Oh, absolutely.
And when they stood next to the piano, David said something about, well, you know, I'm not quite sure about something. And Dad said, oh, don't worry. I'll just, you know, he was concerned about getting in Dad's way,
mm-hmm,
vocally,
mm-hmm,
and Dad just said something about, don't worry about it. I'll just I'll wander in,
right,
every once in a while. And so there wasn't much rehearsal. They,
mm-hmm,
just sort of played around a little and created this wondrous, wondrous piece.
Oh yeah.
And I think it's when you take, I think music transcends everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter what generation you're from. If you love music, then, you know, all bridges are there.
Absolutely.
And that's what happened. And I think that is a really special, extraordinary moment in musical history.
Is it true that that song was sort of written that very day, that they sort,
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that's what I meant by they really wasn't much rehearsal. They kind of, you know, they sort of played around.
That's great.
And that's what they came to. And that's what I love about music and people that know their music.
They told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum.
Peace on earth, can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see.
Our
see the day
we bring
of glory.
See the day when
men live in peace.
So
peace on earth
when we come. Every child must be made.
every child must be made to care. Care enough for his fellow man to give all the love that he can.
I pray my wish will come true. For my child and your child too, you'll see the day of glory.
I pray my day for him
when men of good will live in peace again.
Then
peace on earth. Can it be? Can it be?
Little did the world know that this would be the last of Crosby's Christmas performances. He died suddenly after a round of golf in Spain in 1977. Crosby's name belongs with those of other artists such as Charles Dickens, Clement Moore, and Norman Rockwell in shaping the modern Christmas. The ever-unfolding scroll of American music at Christmas is anchored by Bing Crosby, and the music he made for a generation that never seems to lose its influence.
You're listening to Merry Christmas Radio, the official radio station of MyMerryChristmas.com.
The snow's coming down. I'm watching it fall. Lots of people. The halls, but it's not like Christmas at all. I remember when you were here and all the fun we had last year. Pretty lights on the tree, I'm watching them shine. You should be here with me. The halls, but it's not like Christmas at all. I remember when you were here and all the fun we had last year. If there was a way, I'd hold back these tears, but it's Christmas Day.
Said the little lamb to the shepherd.
The history of romance and Christmas cannot be discussed without talking about Joseph and Mary, those noble souls selected for two very unique and unified roles in the Christmas story. Mary, of course, we know much about. Called blessed amongst all women by the angel who delivered the message of her calling, she was just a teenage girl. A descendant of the royal house of David, she would have been, in another time and another place, perhaps a queen. Instead, she was of humble circumstance, innocent, pure, and chosen. So too was Joseph. Though much of the classic artwork of the Renaissance depicts Joseph as an older man, historians say he may not have been much more than 5 or 6 years older than Mary. It was the custom of the time and place for a man whose intention to marry a woman required he first seek permission and blessing of her father, and then wait a period of a year before the wedding. During that year, they were considered a couple in every other way, and in this case, Mary was considered in every way to be Joseph's wife. They were betrothed, meaning that they were intended only for each other, and rarely could anything cause a separation between them once that commitment was made. It was after this binding commitment to each other was made that Mary had the visitation of Gabriel, who brought her the stunning news of her calling as the mother of Christ. Mary was schooled in the scriptures and had been taught all of her life of the coming of the Messiah. That she was chosen was clearly a surprise to her. But the coming of the Messiah was no surprise at all. But in her calling she had no peer, no one to turn to for comfort and understanding. As her condition progressed and her concerns grew, she went to the one woman who alone could understand, her older cousin Elizabeth. In Elizabeth and Zacharias, we have a second tender love story in the saga of Christmas. Unlike Joseph and Mary, Elizabeth and her husband had been married for decades before the miracle happened to them too. For Elizabeth was carrying a baby as well, one that, like Jesus, would require the upbringing by two parents united in a sacred purpose. As Mary witnessed the birth of John by Elizabeth, she saw a prime example of how a couple in love dealt with matters of faith. Zacharias and Elizabeth would eventually have to flee to the wilderness to raise John, but this they gladly did in their old age. Mary returned to her village ready to face whatever the outcome would be once it became obvious that she was expecting. And sure to her expectations, the reaction was not favorable. But consider the actions of Joseph the carpenter. Upset as he was, he mulled over his options and decided that he could not break his engagement to Mary, for this would mean certain death for her. He loved her, and he was willing to endure a stigma attached to himself that would surely come as a result of Mary having a baby before they were wed. It was only as he tossed fitfully in his sleep over his decision that he too was visited by the angel Gabriel, who told him not to fear taking Mary to wife. Joseph was clearly a man of great faith. Like Mary, he too was called, and he too arose to the situation, caring for her every need as the blessed event drew near. Joseph's part in this story gets little attention, compared to Mary or the Magi or even King Herod, but just as Mary was chosen to be Jesus' mother, so too was Joseph chosen to be his earthly father, to protect him, teach him, and bring him of age to begin his ministry. This could only have happened as a result of great love and devotion between him and Mary. Few acknowledge the fact that Mary and Joseph had a family together outside of the events of Bethlehem. All their days in Egypt and later in Nazareth were spent in raising this family of Jesus and his siblings. We do not learn of Joseph's fate, but Mary's was made plain on Calvary, where she witnessed the brutal crucifixion of Jesus Christ. There are many lessons to be gained from the family story of Joseph and Mary, but clearly many more to be learned of their love story.
Joseph, dearest Joseph,
As we leave you now, we invite you again to the Merry Podcast next for the Big Christmas Show, featuring our tradition of greetings from folks from around the world. If you're interested in participating in that great event, be sure to check out the instructions at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas. We thank all those talented artists and companies that made this edition of the Merry Podcast possible, including our sponsor, PackageFromSanta.com, plus John Schmidt, who provides our theme music for this and every episode of the Merry Podcast. We also acknowledge the artistry and fine contributions of Shay Arender, the Carpenters, Mary Carey of the Merry Podcast Projection Room, and the Merry Forums, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Bing Crosby, David Bowie, Lisa Hugo, Chad Brownlee, Jim Hitchcock, and Rusty Bells of SantaUpdate.com. For all of us at MyMerryChristmas.com, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.